Disrespect will take you places you can't get to from here. Disrespect entertains with a look at the challenges and sometimes the successes of people with disadvantages and disabilities who have had taken from them or have been denied the full choice of possibilities to affect for the better their own lives or the lives of those about them. Welcome to Disrespect's Remembrance Day show. We haven't had Remembrance Day on a Thursday, the day the Disrespect plays, since 2004. And I believe this show is at least that old. You may find a half-hour version of it posted on radioforall.net. First, we kick off this show, appropriately enough, with Wagner, the German march under the Double Eagle.
From the line one night in June, I gave a dinner at Bethune. 7 courses, the most gorgeous meal money could buy or Batman steal. 5 hungry lads welcomed the fish with shouts that nearly cracked the dish. Asparagus came with tender tops, strawberries in cream and mutton chops, said Jenkins as my hand he shook. They'll put this in the history book. We bawled church anthems in coro of Bethlehem and Herman Snow, with drinking songs, a mighty sound to help the good red pommer around. Stories and laughter interspersed, we drowned a long labasse thirst. Trenches in June make throats damn dry. Then through the window, suddenly, badge, stripes and medals all complete, we saw him swagger up the street just like a live man. Corporal Stare. Killed last month at Festubert, caught on patrol near the Boche wire, torn horribly by machine gun fire. He paused, saluted smartly, grinned, then passed away like a puff of wind, leaving us blank astonishment. The song broke, up we started, leant out of the window. Nothing there. Not the least shadow of Corporal Stare, only a quiver of smoke that showed a fag end dropped on the silent road.
That was the march from the movie, A Bridge Too Far.
The Padre. Oh, I'll remember till I die, that lad upon the battlefield. He lay, stark staring at the sky, and though I was to slaughter steeled, sadly I stooped and closed his eyes, so blue, so blinded with surprise. Of bloody wound I saw no trace. His rifle he was holding tense. There was no horror in his face, just terrible indifference. So waxen white and cold it was, a marble piece in battle pause. And beautiful. I never knew a lad with such bright hair of gold, with eyes so utter in their blue, a face so cast in classic mold. I've buried many, but that one haunts me. He might have been my son. I was to horror callous then, and battle memories are dim. Yet mid a host of martyred men, somehow I most remember him. A father's pride, a mother's joy, a poor, bewildered, butchered boy. Well, bone is brittle, blood is red. A flag's a rag when all is said. Victory stuff. An odd name for a poem written by Robert Service. What do you think, lad? What do you think? As the roaring crowd goes by, as the banners flare and the brasses blare and great guns are in the sky, as the women laugh like they've all gone mad and the champagne glasses clink. Ah, you're gripping me hand so tightly, lad. I'm wondering, what do you think? Do you think of the boys we used to know and how they'd have topped the fun? Tom and Charlie and Jack and Joe. Gone now, every one. How they'd have cheered as the joy bells chime and they grabbed each girl for a kiss, and now they're rotting in Flanders slime, and they gave their lives for this. Or else do you think of the many a time we wished we too was dead, up to our knees in the freezing grime with the fires of hell overhead, when the youth and the strength of us sapped away and we cursed in our rage and pain, and yet we haven't a word to say. We're glad we'd do it again. I'm scared that they pity us. Come, old boy, let's leave them their flags and their fuss. We'd surely be hating to spoil their joy with the sight of such wrecks as us. Let's slip away quietly, you and me, and we'll talk of our chums out there. You with your eyes that we'll never see. Me that's wheeled in a chair. By Robert Service, based on a real-life experience when he was an ambulance driver in World War I. There is a city that glitters on the plain. Afar off, we can see its tall cathedral spire. And there we often take our wounded from the little village hospitals to the railhead. Tragic little buildings, these emergency hospitals, town halls, churches, schools. Their cots are never empty, their surgeons never still. The wounded make no moan. They lie limp, heavily bandaged, with bare legs and arms protruding from their blankets. They do not know where they're going. They do not care. Like livestock, they are labeled and numbered. Sometimes they shake our hands and thank us for the drive. The poem is titled, A Casualty. That boy I took in the car last night, the one with the body that awfully sagged away, with his lips blood crisped and his eyes flame bright and his poor hands folded, cold as clay. Oh, I've thought of him all day. For the weary old doctor, he says to me, he'll only last an hour or so. Both of his legs below the knee, blown off by a bomb, so lad, go slow. And please remember, he doesn't know. So I try to drive with never a jar, and there I was cursing the road like mad, when I hear a ghost of a voice from the car. Tell me, old chap, have I copped it bad? So I answers no, and he says I'm glad. Glad, says he. For at 22, life's so splendid, I'd hate to go. There's so much good that a chap might do, and I fought from the start, and I've suffered so. 'Twould be hard to get knocked out now, you know. Forget it, says I, and I drive a while. And I passed him a cheery word or two. But he didn't answer for many a mile, and just as the hospital hove in view, says I, is there nothing more that I can do? Then he opens his eyes and he smiles at me. And he takes my hand in his trembling hold. Thank you. You're far too kind, says he. I'm awfully comfy. Stay. Let's see. I fancy my blankets become unrolled. My feet, please wrap them. They're cold. They're cold.
What passing bells for these who die as cattle? Only the monstrous anger of the guns, only the stuttering rifles' rapid rattle can patter out their hasty orisons. No mockeries for them, no prayer, nor bells, nor any voice of mourning, save the choirs, the shrill, demented choirs of wailing shells, and bugles calling for them from sad shires. What candles may be held to speed them all? Not in the hands of boys, but in their eyes shall shine the holy glimmer of goodbyes. The pallor of girls' brows shall be their pall, their flowers the tenderness of patient minds, and each slow dusk a drawing down of blinds.
We brought him in from between the lines, but we had better have left him lie. For what's the use of risking one's skin for a type that's going to die? What's the use of tearing him loose under a grueling fire when he shot in the head and worse than dead and all messed up on the wire? However, I say we brought him in. Diable. The mud was bad. The trench was crooked and greasy and high, and oh, what a time we had. And often we slipped and often we tripped, but he never made a moan, and how we were wet with blood and with sweat, yet we carried him in like our own. Now there he lies in the dugout dim, awaiting the ambulance. The doctor shrugs his shoulders and remarks, he hasn't a chance. And we squat and smoke at our game of bridge on the glistening straw-packed floor, and above our oaths, you can hear his breath, deep-drawn, in a kind of snore. For the dressing station is long and low, and the candles gutter dim, and the mean light falls on the cold clay walls and our faces bristly and grim, and we flap our cards on the lousy straw, we laugh and jibe as we play, and you'd never know that the cursed foe was less than a mile away. As we con our cards in the rancid gloom, oppressed by that snoring breath, you'd never dream that our broad roof beam was swept by a broom of death. Hi-ho, my turn for the dummy hand. I rise and I stretch a bit, for the fetid air is making me yawn and my cigarette's unlit. So I go to the nearest candle flame. The man we brought is there, and his face is white in the shabby light. And I stand at his feet and stare. I stand a while and quietly stare, for strange though it seems to be, the dying Boche on the stretcher there has a queer resemblance to me. It gives one kind of a turn, you know, to come on a thing like that. It's just as if I were lying there with a turban of blood for a hat, lying there in a coat gray-green instead of a coat gray-blue, with one of my eyes all shot away and my brain half tumbling through, lying there with a chest that heaves like a bellows up and down, and cheek as white as snow on a grave, lips that are coffee brown. And confound him, too, he wears, like me, on his finger, a wedding ring, and around his neck, as around my own, by a greasy bit of string, a locket hangs with a woman's face, and I turn it about to see, just as I thought, on the other side, the faces of children three, clustered together, cherub-like, three laughing little girls with the usual tiny rosebud mouths and the usual silken curls. Zoot, I say, he has beaten me, for I have only two, and I shove the locket beneath his shirt, feeling a little blue. For it isn't cheerful to see a man, the marvelous work of God, crushed in the mutilation mill, crushed to a smeary clod. And it isn't cheerful to hear him moan, but it isn't that I mind. It isn't the anguish that goes with him. It's the anguish he leaves behind. For his going will open a tragic door that gives on a world of pain, and the death he dies for those who live and love will die again and again. So here I am back at my cards once more, but it's kind of spoiling my play, thinking of those three brats of his, so many mile away, but war is war, and he's only a Boche, and we all of us take our chance. Still, all the same, I'll be mighty glad to be here in the ambulance. One foe the less, but all the same, I'm heartily glad I'm not the man who gave him his busted head, the sniper who fired the shot. No trumps you make it, I thought you said. You'll pardon me if I err. For a moment, I thought of other things. Mon Dieu, qu'il fasse de guerre. We'll be right back. by S.E. Kaiser. The poem's titled Unsubdued. I have hoped, I have planned, I have striven. To the will I have added the deed. All that was in me I've given. I have prayed, but the gods would not heed. I have dared and reached only disaster. I have battled and broken my lance. I am bruised by a pitiless master that the weak and the timid call chance. I am old, I am bent, I am cheated of all that life urged me to win. But name me not with the defeated. Tomorrow again I begin.
You've been listening to an unusual Remembrance Day tribute on Disrespect. We opened with Joseph Franz Wagner's Under the Double Eagle and segued into Simon Russell Beale's Corporal Stare from The Pity of War, a BBC Music CD. Next, you heard A Bridge Too Far from Great War Themes on the Pickwick label. Hamilton poetry reader and personality Rick Harrett and the Padre. Track 2 from Traditions 135, the Queen's Own Rifles of Canada, Regimental Band and Bugles. Again, Rick Harrett and A Casualty. High on a Hill, the Band of the Blues and Royals on Great War Themes. Anthem for Doomed Youth by Simon Russell Beale. Only a Bosch, again, Rick Harrett. Silver Bugles from Traditions 135. And last, Vimy Ridge, again, from Traditions 135. The aircraft flybys were courtesy of Warbird Heaven, to whom we're grateful, www.warbirdheaven.de. Our final poem, Unsubdued, by Rick Harrett. Our thanks to the many people who made this possible, and for 2 minutes.
Our thoughts with the men and women who in war gave their lives.
And now it's time for Disrespect's weekly review of the news. These are not the newspaper articles in full that we read for you, but we identify the newspapers in the broadcast. These are abridgments or condensations of those articles for Disrespect. First, France braces for further labor unrest. Pension bill passes. The French government passed President Nicolas Sarkozy's pension bill to increase the minimum retirement age as labor unions prepared for a new day of strikes and protests. The bill, under which the minimum pension age will go to 62 from 60 and full pension age from 65 to 67, was passed by the National Assembly by 336 votes to 233. Sarkozy wants to enact the law on November 15th. France's Constitutional Court, however, may need more time to review it. Some say Sarkozy has won by passing tough legislation, said Jerome Fourquet, a deputy director at IFOP, a Paris-based polling company. But the reform caused so much pain, it has created resentment, and with any future reform, social unrest can be sparked again. Voted or not, this problem isn't over, said Bernard Thibault, head of the CGT union. Most of the unions that have suspended the strike are calling for a new meeting, he told Liberation newspaper. This reform won't break France's social pact, Labour Minister Eric Wirth said after the vote. In the name of the government, I am proud to have carried through a reform that is in the common good. The risk premium on French bonds fell. Investors demanded 36.6 basis points more to buy 10-year French bonds than comparable German securities, down from 41.6 basis points on October 12th. The government says the changes will help France cope with an aging population and balance the pension system's budget by 2018. That from the National Post, bylined Hélène Fouquet, and Gregory Viscusi. Judge rules girl 5 can be sued over bike accident. Supreme Court Justice Paul Wooten refused earlier this month to toss out negligence claims against Juliette Breitman. Juliette, her mother, and others are being sued by the estate of an 87-year-old pedestrian who said she was severely hurt when hit by training bikes that Juliette and a boy, also 4, were racing down a New York City sidewalk in April 2009. The woman, Claire Minot, underwent surgery for a fractured hip and died 3 months later. Juliet was 3 months shy of five at the time. The judge says there's no evidence a child of that age couldn't appreciate the danger of riding a bicycle into an elderly woman. Citing precedents as far back as 1928, he ruled she is old enough to be sued and the case can proceed. His decision also allows for a lawsuit to proceed against the boy's family over the incident. For children above the age of four, there is no bright-line rule, Wooten wrote. And that from the Toronto Star, Sunday, October 31st. And of interest to listeners who value community radio, Ottawa pushing ahead with copyright bill amid opposition. Artists say C-32 doesn't compensate individual creators for new uses of their work. The federal government is pushing ahead with a bill to update Canada's copyright laws. Bill C-32 received its second reading in the House of Commons on Tuesday. Although three opposition parties have criticized aspects of the bill, they are expected to pass it in principle so it can move to the legislative committee that would discuss amendments. At this stage, however, amendments could only address existing language. New issues could not be added. There is a levy on blank cassettes and CDs that compensates songwriters and musicians for the copying of their music. The government has been adamant, however, that such a levy will not be applied to digital players such as iPods. Quote, it attacks a system that's been a Canadian solution for decades, Alain Pinault, National Director of the Canadian Conference of the Arts, said the bill's failure to extend copyright collectives into the digital era. It bypasses that in favor of lawsuits, he said. Users' groups are pleased to see common practices such as format shifting and time shifting legalized, but are outraged that producers will be able to install digital locks on video games, movies, and CDs that could trump the users' rights. The artistic community, however, says the whole law is flawed because it relies so heavily on the courts to decide what is fair and what isn't, a route it says only big producers can afford. The creative community got support from an unusual source last month when the Quebec Bar Association also came out against the bill as it's currently written, arguing it would only encourage litigation. In a letter to the industry minister, Tony Clement, the association's director, Gilles Ouimet, lists many deficiencies in the bill, questions whether it brings Canada into line with international law, and writes that it, quote, negates the collective exercise of copyright and favors individual litigation through unpractical and unrealistic remedies, unquote. It really shifts the burden to the artist, said Maureen Parker, executive director of the Writers Guild of Canada, which represents screenwriters. It is not our job to police and enforce this. It's their job to draft legislation that is forward-thinking and enforceable. That from the Globe and Mail, Monday, November 1st, byline Kate Taylor. Stunning resignation leaves fate of party HST up in the air. A caucus rebellion among BC Liberals has pressured Premier Gordon Campbell to quit abruptly, leaving his party in disarray and casting even more doubt on the future of his controversial harmonized sales tax. The Premier made a last-ditch effort to reverse his fortunes with a rare televised address and a pledge of a major income tax cut, but it wasn't enough. According to several Liberal sources, party members had begun a plot to force him out of office. Mr. Campbell's resignation just 17 months into his four-year term, coupled with BC's fixed election dates, leaves the province in the extraordinary position of having an unelected premier for 2 years or more. Last week, the premier gave every indication he was digging in despite his rock-bottom popularity. Just 8 months ago, Mr. Campbell seemed to be riding out the unhappiness over the HST, with the Winter Olympics bolstering his popularity. But in the spring, as the anti-HST movement picked up momentum, his party support and even more his personal approval ratings were in free fall. A province-wide petition received certification in August and triggered a 2011 non-binding plebiscite on the future of the unloved tax. Mr. Camel, seeking to defuse anti-HST anger, promised last month to abide by that vote, but the petition backers continued to threaten his MLAs with recall under a BC law that allows voters to fire their MLAs. Blair Leckstrom, who quit Mr. Campbell's cabinet in the summer to protest against the HST, said the premier should have quit after the Olympics. He wouldn't say yet if he intends to run for the leadership, but he said the contest will be dominated by the HST. Do we pull a pin and do what the vast majority of British Columbians are asking, that is, cancel it? That from the Globe and Mail, Thursday, November 4th. Justine Hunter in Victoria and Wendy Stuick in Vancouver. BC has the most Canadian jail and police-involved deaths, Civil Liberties Group. British Columbia has more than twice as many jail and police-involved deaths as Ontario, despite the fact that Ontario has three times the population, says a new report released by a Civil Liberties Group. The BC Civil Liberties Association is calling on the BC government to change how such deaths are investigated and to improve efforts to prevent them. With 267 deaths over the past 15 years, BC had the largest number of deaths per year of any of the six provinces and territories for which numbers were available, the report said. While records for BC, Ontario, New Brunswick, and Yukon stretched back to 1992, records for Saskatchewan and the Northwest Territories spanned a shorter time period. Although the BC government has promised to form a civilian investigative agency, it seems to be dragging its heels, suggested the head of the Civil Liberties Group, Robert Holmes. That from the National Post, Thursday, October 28th. No byline, but Post Media News. G20 charges dropped over police lack of judicial authority. Police conducted one of the largest preemptive raids during Toronto's G20 summit weekend without a warrant because they thought they didn't need one. The Crown decided otherwise and dropped all charges against about 100 people arrested on University of Toronto campus June 27th. Brendan Crawley, a spokesman for Ontario's Ministry of the Attorney General, said, "In all cases, the Crown has an ongoing duty to assess charges as they move forward, and if the Crown determines at any time that there is no longer a reasonable prospect of conviction, the Crown is duty-bound to withdraw the charges. That is what happened, and why." The so-called Feeney warrant in question has been entrenched in law since a 1997 Supreme Court of Canada case. It's required when police want to enter residences and obliges them to meet a high burden of proof. Said law professor Kent Roach, "You can only enter without warrant in very narrow circumstances. It's necessary to prevent imminent bodily harm or death, or it's necessary to prevent the imminent loss of evidence." Most of the people arrested in the raid were protesters from Quebec, and some later accused police of profiling them because of their province of origin. Montreal lawyer Julius Gray said, "The whole weekend, generally what you saw was a massive abuse of rights. This raid would be one of them. Picking up people who are asleep in gymnasiums, picking up people when you don't have a warrant on university campuses, all these things are well over the line." And that from the Globe and Mail, Anna Mailer Paperny in Toronto. Police face fines for not wearing ID at G20. Nearly 100 Toronto police officers will be disciplined for removing their name tags at the G20 summit, says the city's police chief. Many of the people who confronted police over the tumultuous 3 days of protests that closed down Toronto's core said officers were not wearing badge numbers or name tags on their uniforms, allegations that were bolstered by photographs in the media. When asked what kind of punishment would be handed out, Chief Blair said that has yet to be determined, but in the discussion, I believe, is the loss of a day's pay. That would amount to about $300 for a first-class constable. When asked why an officer would remove his or her badge, the chief said some of the name tags could have come off during scuffles with protesters, but other officers were likely trying to hide their identities. Opposition MPs told the chief they have heard repeated stories from protesters who say they were inhumanely treated by officers. Toronto lawyer Eric Gillespie, who's heading up one of two class actions related to the G20, both are awaiting certification, said it's encouraging to see police taking internal actions to discipline their own officers for not wearing badges. But the fact that obscured badges were so common at the high-profile event is a bad sign when it comes to police accountability. That from the Globe and Mail, Thursday, November 4th, bylined Gloria Galloway in Ottawa and Anna Mailer Papperny in Toronto. Community Housing CEO and Ford discuss property sale. Now that he's mayor-elect, Rob Ford is asking questions about the controversial sale of 20 Toronto Community Housing Corporation homes at well below market rates. So he met with Keiko Nakamura, CEO of the Toronto Community Housing Corporation, to get some answers. The sale, approved by council and widely publicized in the spring, saw the properties going to Wigwaman, an Aboriginal housing organization. Wigwaman is paying only about $400,000 in outstanding mortgages. Another 22 TCHC houses are still up for sale. The agency says a number of community agencies have expressed interest in buying them. Many of the houses are in established neighborhoods, including the Upper Beach and Broadview Danforth. They are each worth close to $500,000 or more. TCHC doesn't have the money to maintain or replace them. The agency is selling another 5 such houses on the open market because it couldn't find a housing provider. Money from those sales will be reinvested in the TCHC portfolio. That's from the Toronto Star, October 30th, Donovan Vincent, staff reporter. And from the Toronto Star editorial, a couple of days later, Homes for the Homeless is top priority. Reopen these doors to family in need, October 30th. Taxpayers should thank Catherine Porter for calling attention to the issue of Toronto community housing buildings sitting empty for years. It's such a waste. I understand well that TCHC has a huge backlog of repairs, so I understand what it means for people living in TCHC housing. I volunteered for a number of years at TCH's Sparrow Way development. I understand TCH needs to prioritize, but obviously some TCHC bureaucrats are not thinking right. I can understand not repairing stoves, even if one element on a stove still worked. I can understand not repairing washers and dryers if there was even one working washer and dryer in the laundry room of the development. The people there still had a place they could call home, and they could still cook and do their laundry. But to spread out the repair of these empty homes over years is beyond comprehension. Isn't there a mandate to first of all house people? I should think the priority should be to fix empty units and house more people. Is a Crown Corporation NGO partnership not possible? An NGO such as Habitat for Humanity has access to a lot of volunteers with the skills to repair these houses. NGOs, volunteers, and the TCH working together can make these empty houses home for people. The Star would be doing an even greater service for the public if it asks why this is not happening and helps bring the parties together. And that letter by Marie Kwok in Toronto. And the good news portion of the show takes a decidedly ambivalent turn on this anniversary of death in exchange for freedom. Criminal charges against OCAP and allies at Liberal HQ go out the window. On November 4th, the Crown Attorney's Office finally faced reality and dropped charges of mischief and forcible entry against 9 members and supporters of OCAP. These preposterous charges were laid by the police on July 21st after an OCAP delegation went into the Liberal offices, hung a banner out the window, and addressed a crowd that had gathered outside to resist the cut to the special diet and demand the raising of welfare and disability rates. There are now no ongoing conditions or criminal records for the 9 to deal with, although the Crown sought to save face by insisting on each person making a small charitable donation under their system of diversion. All nine people were first told they would be facing trespass charges, but this was changed to mischief, a criminal charge, and later that evening, forcible entry charges were added. Each of those accused had to line up a surety to put up money and vouch for them, were subjected to strip searches, and were locked up over a period spanning 2 days before a judge ordered their release. Bail conditions placed limits on the activity of those charged, and their right to associate with each other was limited. The Crown sought much more serious restrictions that were beaten back by Mike Leetold, the lawyer, to whom we all owe a huge round of thanks for his skillful and dedicated efforts on our behalf from the day we were charged through to the end. Shamefully, two of the delegation to the Liberal offices, Anne and Lenny, are still facing trespass charges, and it will be nothing short of disgusting if these are not dropped without delay. Anne is a member of OCAP who drives a wheelchair and uses a communication board via an assistant to express herself fully. Because the police are ableist and lack respect for disabled people or any understanding of their issues, Anne and her assistant were dealt with separately from the rest of the delegation to the Liberal offices. They were given summonses to appear on trespass charges and at this point are still facing a trial in January. If there is a trace of shame or decency in the system, or even a desire to pretend there is, their charges will join the others in the garbage can. The July 21st action at the offices of the Liberal Party was part of OCAB's fight to challenge the McGuinty government's elimination of the special diet and their decision to consign those living on sub-poverty welfare payments to even greater poverty. On that day, no one engaged in any forcible entry or terrified office staff, as the Crown implied. But that's not really the point, because our real crime was to resist poverty. When the G20 leaders or the McGuinty liberals get together to discuss how to impose their austerity measures on people, they are not just within the law, but are actually protected by lines of police. When poor people organize to challenge their plans and build social resistance to it, however, they are, quote, breaching the peace, unquote, and challenging the rule of law. The real purpose of the charges we have just defeated was to try to intimidate and stifle resistance to poverty and austerity. Not for the first time, an attempt of this sort has failed. Our fight for living, income, and dignity will continue and grow, and they don't have enough police and prosecutors to silence us. That from an OCAP press release, November 8th. And that's all the news we have for Disrespect This Remembrance Day. Come back next week. You know we will have more. And to take us out, something that everybody recognizes, to celebrate the anniversary of the Washington Post, the 50th anniversary, quite a long time ago, John Philip Sousa, the Washington Post March. We'll be right back. You can now listen to the show wherever you're near the internet. Disrespect is streamed live at http://cfmu.msumcmaster.ca. You can email us at dialogue, D-I-A-L-O-G-U-E, at radio.fm. Disrespect is archived at www.radioforall.net. That's the number four, not the word, radioforall.net. You can find the shows under its name, Disrespect. Tune in at Showtime, Thursdays at noon, 93.3 FM, CFMU, to see if something more topical hasn't displaced the show that we planned. Disrespect is digitally edited from live telephone and studio interviews.